Okay, everyone, please take a seat. Thank you. So, thank you. So, Mr. Robertson, if you can introduce our item four, and then I believe staff request to change slightly the order of who will present first.
Okay, so now we are headed back to item four, the informational item on the state of surface water in the region. And I'm going to hand it back to Chris Rose, section manager Chris Rose, head of the Irrigated Lands Program.
Thank you, Mr. Robinson, and thank you, Chair Ruff, and members of the board. Again, this is Christopher Rose, Irrigated Lands Program Manager. This is item four, continuing from yesterday. And for those of people in the audience who were not here yesterday, this item is surface water quality conditions in the Central Coast region. This is part of a two informational item set that we will be presenting to the board. So again, this item is surface water quality conditions, and then we intend in May to have a similar information item, which is the groundwater quality conditions report for the board and the public. As Ms. Robertson mentioned yesterday, our original plan was to unveil requirement options for AgriWater 4.0 in June, the June board meeting. However, we have moved that to the September board meeting, leaving us a little more time in the June board meeting of this year to talk about some other things other than AgriWater 4.0. Unfortunately, due to the weather, we were not able to have the field trip that was originally scheduled for yesterday afternoon. We had a lot of interest, not only from staff, but also from board members and even members of the public, where we were going to be visiting a farm and having a discussion about lysimeter technology. At this point in time, we plan on rescheduling that for a later board meeting, either May or June. And that will just be one of our sort of ancillary discussions with respect to moving forward with AgriWater 4.0 and outreaching not only with some of the younger faces in the room, but also perhaps even some new faces in the room. Speakers today include Sarah Green Lopez. She is the president of Preservation Inc., who is in charge of, or they are doing this corporate monitoring program on behalf of the AgriWater requirements for growers. Ms. Lopez will be presentation about the water quality results as a result of that monitoring. Ms. Lopez will be one of our staff, Mary Hamilton. Ms. Hamilton is currently running the CCAP program, the Central Coast Ambient Monitoring Program, and she will talk about surface water quality conditions using the CCAP data. After Ms. Hamilton, we'll have Paula Richter, who is in the Irrigated Lands Regulatory Program, sort of new to the Irrigated Lands Regulatory Program. And Ms. Richter will be talking about repairing and wetland conditions in the Central Coast region. Following Ms. Richter, then we will have Ms. Elaine Saar. And Ms. Saar will provide conclusions and steps for how what we've heard today and yesterday will be used as we move forward with developing AgriWater 4.0. And then I believe at that point, then, Mr. Chair, we have had a request, and I think you have accepted the request for Ms. K. Mercer and Ms. Abby Taylor Silva to have a presentation and talk for 10 minutes. Thank you.
All right, so let's proceed.
And then if I could ask Ms. Sarah Green Lopez to come up. Thank you.
Thank you, Chris. Good morning, Chairman Wolf, members of the board.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you, and thank you also to Chris Rose for providing this opportunity for me to come down here and discuss the cooperative monitoring results with you. We monitor over 50 sites for a list of well over 20 parameters. And so today I'm just going to focus on those parameters or parameter groups that are the most direct indicators of agricultural impacts on water quality, partly because they are the most direct indicators and partly because they are probably going to be the first indicators of change as growers make management improvements in trying to improve water quality. So those groups would be indicators of eroded soils in the water, which we measure as turbidity and total suspended solids, indicators of fertilizers and soil amendments, which we measure as nitrate, phosphate, and ammonia. I'm just going to focus on nitrate today, and pest control products, which would include insecticides, herbicides, and fungicides. We measure those impacts both as aquatic toxicity, which you heard Bryn Phillips talking about quite a bit yesterday. We measure both water column toxicity and sediment toxicity to invertebrates. And then we also, at times, directly measure specific pest control products. So, for example, insecticides like pyrethroids, organophosphates, neonicotinoids, also a suite of herbicides and fungicides. In addition to talking about water quality status today, I'm going to talk about trends that we're finding in the data set, and I just wanted to be clear about some vocabulary. Sometimes what we see in the data are patterns, which I'm going to define as an increasing or decreasing trajectory of monitoring results over time. So unless a time series is a completely flat line, it's going to have some upward or downward pattern. Whether or not that is meaningful or biologically meaningful is a different question. But sometimes I think that before we have enough data to necessarily see a statistically significant trend, if we see the same pattern all over the region, it's probably worth making a note of. When we talk about statistically significant change, that's what I'm going to use the word trend to refer to today. I'm also going to talk about both concentrations and loading of some of these parameters, and so I just wanted to make sure that everybody's clear on those concepts. And part of the reason for that, the concentration is sort of, at the end of the day, it's the thing that matters to the biology in the stream. Loading is also important, both for downstream receiving waters and also because as farmers do make management changes, I think one of the things we're seeing is that those changes manifest often as changes in loading and not necessarily the changes in concentration that the textbook might have told us to expect to see, and I'll be elaborating on that a little bit. So just two examples here. If we start out with a beaker with 10 milliliters of water in it and it has 10 balls of something, call it nitrate, call it whatever you want, if you reduce that volume of water by half, but it still has 10 balls in it, you still got the same load of balls, you just have twice the concentration. And as discharge volumes are reduced, sometimes we will see decreasing concentrations, but other times we will see increasing concentrations while loading remains the same or decreases. So it's important to have that in mind. Another example of what can happen is we may have this same volume of water with 10 balls, and then we end up with half the volume of water and half the number of balls in that volume of water. And so the load is reduced by half, but the concentration remains the same. So just two concepts to keep in mind. Now I'm going to show a series of maps that show median values for all of the cooperative monitoring sites for the 2017 monitoring year. So we're looking at very recent and relevant data. Each of these dots on the map represents one monitoring site. On this map, you see the Pajaro and Salinas valleys. Each dot represents one monitoring site, and the size of the bubble, is scaled according to what the median stream flow was at the site. And I think the hydrology of these monitoring sites is just so important to understanding why the water quality is what it is. It's important to understand how much water is in the stream, where does it come from, and what was the baseline water quality in that water prior to the introduction of discharges or upstream of those discharges. So at our northern sites, we saw median or typical flows of anywhere from a small negative CFS due to either tidal influence or the wind driving the water upstream, up to about 25 CFS. And in storms, however, which we don't necessarily see the impact of storm flows in these median values, but our max storm flows in this hydrologic unit were on the order of thousands to tens of thousands of CFS, so much higher than typical. The Pajaro sites flowed year-round, except for Watsonville Slough, and in the Salinas area, our tidal drain influence sites flowed year-round, but the tributaries that are tributary to the Salinas River and tributary to the Reclamation Canal watershed that are located east of Highway 101, those were periodically dry. I will say that our main stem Salinas sites, which are also periodically dry, had a lot more water than they did in the prior year, or 2016. In the south, that's Sloan and Santa Barbara counties, we just have less water overall. The median or typical flow range was only 0 to 7 CFS. We, in some cases, had minimum flows that were negative due to either tidal influence or the wind. And our maximum storm flows in the south were only about 300 CFS. We saw those in the main stem Santa Ynez River and in Wharton Creek. Many of the creeks and canals in the south flowed year-round, but about 40% of those sites were seasonally dry, and that includes some of the main stem rivers, like the Santa Maria River at Highway 1, the Santa Ynez River. The next couple maps are going to be looking at nitrate. If you could ignore for the moment the size of those bubbles, the color scheme there indicates the median nitrate concentration, with green indicating a median nitrate concentration below 1 part per million as N, and 1 part per million is the aquatic life threshold for biostimulation, I believe. And so you can see that we do have some sites that on a median basis, and in some cases, during almost every single monitoring event, met that objective. The yellow bubbles indicate sites that were above 1 but below 10 on average, on a median basis, and 10 is the drinking water standard. We do have some sites that met that 10 part per million standard on a median basis. However, about half of the sites most typically exceed even the 10 part per million drinking water objective. And then orange indicates values above 10 parts per million, with red and purple indicating much higher median nitrate concentrations. And if you look now at the relative size of these bubbles, they're sized to represent nitrate load. And what we usually see is that loading is driven by stream flow, because it's a product of the flow times the concentration. So, for example, the Salinas River at Greenfield, it's a very low nitrate concentration, but there's a high nitrate load there because of the high stream flow. The only places we really see high loading with low stream flow are cases of very high nitrate concentration. In Slough and Santa Barbara counties, we had kind of the same pattern. In fact, the median nitrate range is almost identical to the north, about 0.1 to 64 milligrams per liter. None of the sites actually met that 1 milligram per liter aquatic life threshold on a median basis, but quite a few were close. All the Santa Maria sites, except for the main stem river at Highway 1, were above 10 parts per million on a median basis, and we had two South Coast sites, that's down here where we are today, that also typically exceed 10 parts per million. And we see the same pattern in the south as in the north, which is that loading is typically driven by stream flow, except for some of the very high nitrate concentrations. The next two maps look at sediment. And the concentration color scale here represents our turbidity measurements. In the north, in the Pajaro and Salinas hydrologic units, we typically saw turbidities of 2 to 343 NTUs. The green dots represent sites that were below 25 NTUs on a median basis, and 25 NTUs is an aquatic life threshold for, I believe it's juvenile steelhead feeding patterns. So we have quite a few sites in the Pajaro and a few in the Salinas area that were below 25 NTUs on a median basis. And then with the yellow, orange, and red colors indicating much higher turbidities. The Salinas sites typically exceeded that 25 NTU aquatic life threshold, but we know that sediment loading is a product of both the turbidity and the flow. And typically we saw our sites with higher flows having higher sediment loading, except, again, where there's very high turbidity. And in that case, even with a low flow, you can see high loading from a low flow, high turbidity site. In the south, there's a bit of a contrast between the Santa Maria area and the rest of the sites. A lot of the rest of the sites met that 25 NTU aquatic life threshold on a median basis. The total range, again, is almost identical between the south and the north, about 2 NTU to just over 400 NTUs on a median basis. And again, with most of the Santa Maria sites exceeding that 25 NTU threshold, and the sites outside that area typically meeting it. The next few slides are a consolidated discussion of the pie charts that are in your package regarding trends and patterns that we're seeing in the data. So this is a trend analysis using the seasonal Mann-Kendall test on all of the cooperative monitoring results from January 2005 up through December of 2017. And when we ran the test on all of the years and all of the months of data, about 70% of the monitoring sites showed decreasing statistically significant trends in stream flow. And if we were to look at the non-significant patterns, that number would actually be up around 90%. There are only one or two sites that showed significant increasing trends, and then a group of sites that mostly showed decreasing patterns, but because of variability, it wasn't a statistically significant trend. Now, obviously, we've had a long period of drought, and the effect of climate is most likely acting on these trends, but we would also expect that growers trying to improve water quality are better managing their discharges, and that we would also absolutely expect to produce significant decreasing trends. And this is one of those questions that goes back to the hydrology. Where is most of the water in the stream coming from? At sites where most of the water in the stream is coming from a dam release, we expect these trends are probably due to the effect of climate. At sites where most of the water in the stream is due to agricultural discharges, if we see a decreasing trend, there's a higher likelihood that that trend is due to growers better managing their discharges. And so I don't know that we'll ever be able to fully tease out the separate effects of climate versus grower management, but I took a look at a few items in that regard that I wanted to share with you. So the first thing I did was rerun that trend analysis, ending it prior to the drought. So just running it 2005 to 2011. And at that point in time, 35% of our sites, or about half of what we have now, were showing statistically significant declining trends in stream flow. And if you look at which sites were showing those trends, it's exactly the sites we would expect to find showing trends if growers are better managing their discharges. It's in those sites in the Salinas and Santa Maria areas, which act as conveyances for agricultural discharges. So I think this 35% figure here is very likely due to grower management and not the effect of climate. Another thing I did was rerun the analysis on all of the years of the data set, but constrain it to only the quote-unquote dry months. And it doesn't mean that, so this is May through September, that doesn't mean that all of our October through April results are necessarily storm events, but you might expect that rain had some impact on the monitoring results in those months. So just constraining it to those heavy irrigation months where they're almost certainly dry as far as precipitation goes, and 60% of the sites show significant decreasing trends in stream flow. Another thing we can look at is patterns or trends in management practices that would be expected to affect stream flow. So this is a chart from the Monterey County Water Resources Agency's 2015 extraction report. And this dotted circle here is just to draw your attention to this pattern, which goes all the way back to 1993. But the circle just encapsulates all of the years that overlap with the ag order. And there's this really strong tens of thousands of acres increase in the use of drip irrigation and this really strong concurrent decrease in a practice called sprinkler and furrow. And that's where the growers will use a sprinkler to establish the crop and then switch over to furrow irrigation to finish the crop once the plants are bigger. And that's been replaced with either drip or a combination of sprinkler and drip. And would we expect this kind of change in practice to result in a reduction in agricultural discharges? Absolutely. I'm just going to talk quickly about trends in nitrate and sediment, and then I'm going to switch over to talking about toxicity. We don't see as many trends in nitrate concentration. In fact, we see, looking at all the sites, we see about 35% showing decreasing trends in concentration, and a few more showing increasing trends. Thank you. But then when you look down at loads, there's a very strong trend towards decreasing nitrate loading and very little, in fact, increased nitrate loading. And then this is just to show you the difference between the northern unit and the southern unit. In the south, we have 100% of the sites showing decreasing nitrogen loading. These are the trends in sediment. Again, not quite as many trends as with the stream flow, but about a third of the sites showing decreased turbidity and about two-thirds of the sites showing decreased sediment loading. We expect that turbidity is related to stream flow, and so you will see the effects of climate on these trends as well.
And by the way, because we have quite a few speakers, you know, if you had questions, I'm not suggesting we wait the end of all the speakers and then you ask your questions. So after within each presentation, you know, feel free to ask a question. But on the sedimentation, do you have a chart or so where we look at wet years versus dry years?
I have that analysis. I didn't include it in this presentation for the sake of time. Off the top of my head, no, I better not do that. I can get back to you on that.
Good for you.
Okay, I'm going to focus on the toxicity discussion on toxicity to invertebrates, but just wanted to make a quick note about toxicity to algae that we saw in 2017. We don't see it widespread throughout the region. We really just saw it in 2017 in one sample each from the Pajaro unit, the Salinas unit, the Santa Maria unit, and the Santa Ynez unit. We saw it in four samples from this area here around Santa Barbara, once in Bell Creek, once in Franklin Creek, and twice in Glen Annie. And that can be an indicator of herbicides from a variety of sources in the water. And we do a little bit of direct herbicide testing. So this discussion can be developed a little bit. I think we have a little bit more data to address what might be causing that toxicity. The next couple slides are regarding toxicity to hyalella in sediment. So when Bryn Phillips talked yesterday about toxicity to hyalella, he was talking about water column tests. These are tests where we take sediment from the monitoring sites and send it to the laboratory, and hyalella are exposed to our sediment right alongside a non-toxic control sediment. And these are the average hyalella survival rate from our April monitoring event and our September monitoring event across all sites in each of the hydrologic units. And so on average, hyalella exposed to sediment from several of these hydrologic units showed 100% or close to 100% survival rates. And hyalella, if you recall, are the most sensitive indicator to pyrethroids in the sediment.
Can I ask you for some clarification what our test was used?
This is the, the 10 and day test.
What's that?
10-day test.
10-day test.
Mm-hmm.
Any chronic testing?
So we do look at a growth endpoint, and I don't have that slide in this presentation, but the growth endpoint would be the indicator of sublethal effects. And sometimes we do find those even when we see high survival. It's not very, very frequent, and I don't know if maybe Mary knows, is that 10-day test considered chronic because of the length of the test? Okay, so there's two issues when you do toxicity testing. There's acute versus chronic, and there's lethal versus sublethal. And so in this case, we're running a chronic test due to the 10-day length of the test, and we have a lethal and a sublethal endpoint, survival and growth. So these would be considered chronic survival effects.
So tying a little bit to that still on the chart, how can we have a survival rate over 100%? I mean, yeah, I'm like, are we encouraging reproduction or?
That's simply when these are actually percent survival relative to performance in the control. So this is when our test samples, for whatever reason, outperform the control. We see this all the time in the algae tests because our samples are so nutrient enriched. The algae exposed to our sample water often outperform the algae in the control water by a factor of 2 or even 3 sometimes. This would just be because the 314 hydrologic unit is small. We only have 3 sites, and sometimes they're dry. So this is what's happened here is there was probably one test with a 120% survival rate, and because there were so few tests overall, that just pulled the average up for that hydrologic unit.
Thank you.
Also, this is the first time we've ever looked at sediment toxicity at 2 different times of the year. Typically, we only look during what's called the spring index period, and so this was also an opportunity to see whether our results would be different in April versus September. And then I would just point out that we see the more high-level toxicity in the Salinas and Santa Maria hydrologic units. In many cases, we saw comparable or higher survival in the September tests versus the spring tests. I'm not going to get very deep into the corresponding sediment chemistry today, but alongside those toxicity tests, we also measured pyrethroid concentrations and chlorpyrifos concentrations, and I've condensed those results into toxic units. Bryn Phillips explained the concept of a toxic unit yesterday. It's how many times the median lethal concentration do we have of measured pesticide in that sample, and this is a summation of all of the pyrethroids and chlorpyrifos that were measured. And so the x-axis shows toxic units. There's a couple of high outliers that were down here that are not on this graph, but they showed low survival rates, as you would expect. And then the high-level survival rates for those same samples are over there on the y-axis. And here I have this red dotted line at half a toxic unit, which is usually where we expect to see impacts to the hylala in our monitoring results. And I confused myself with this slide on Wednesday. We'll see if I can explain it. But I just wanted to point out this group of samples where we saw high survival in spite of the presence of toxic units, and then this group of sites where we saw low survival in spite of fewer than half a measured toxic unit. And as Bryn mentioned yesterday, there's a lot of variability, but usually the curve has this general shape of high survival with lower toxic units and low survival with high toxic units. Okay. The last thing I wanted to say about toxicity to hyalella in sediment is just looking at possible changes over time. So this is a comparison of our spring 2010 results to our spring 2017 results. And in most cases, just on a hydrologic unit average basis, the survival was slightly higher. I don't know if that's significant, and time will tell. You know, as we move 2-3 years into the future and can put another bar on this graph, I think that'll be instructive. We did see higher survival in the San Juan area, still quite an impact. We're only looking at a 40% average survival rate, but it's better than we had in the spring of 2010. And then Salinas had the opposite pattern. Switching over now to water column toxicity to invertebrates, historically we've only looked at the Ceridaphnia or the water flea. And this is one of those cases where we see more patterns than we do trends, and it's because we only monitor water column toxicity 4 times a year as opposed to 12 times a year with our other parameters. But I think when we see a pattern at 75% of our sites, it's probably worth noting. And in this case, an increasing pattern is a good thing because it means higher survival rates. And 75% of our sites are showing increasing patterns in Ceridaphnia survival. 6% of the sites show statistically significant trends. 25% of the sites were showing decreasing survival rates, but none of those were statistically significant. And at this point, with only 4 months of 4 months a year of data, the majority of our trends are not significant, but that's a pretty strong pattern. Okay. Now, why do we have that pattern? I'm probably the third speaker on this meeting agenda who's talked to you about the reduction in organophosphate detections and usage over time. So these are averages of all of our efforts to monitor organophosphates in the water column dating back to 2006. And the results were basically much higher prior to about 2008, 2009. And since then, they've been lower. I didn't remove outliers from this data set, but if I had removed high outliers, this curve would be even more obvious. So then we've also talked a lot at this meeting about the switch to usage of more neonicotinoid pesticides, which are expected to impact the invertebrate Chironomus more so than the Ceridaphnia. And this in 2017, we did monitor toxicity to Chironomus, and we did monitor for neonicotinoids. So our 2017 average neonicotinoid detections are over here. I wanted to put them on the same graph so that you could see what those detection levels are relative to what we've historically measured for organophosphates. So the orange dot is imidacloprid. This black square is thiamethoxam. We actually find more thiamethoxam in terms of detection frequency than we do imidacloprid, which is interesting because I think that's a parameter that the DPR model that was presented yesterday deprioritized based on the fact that it's 10 times less toxic than imidacloprid, and it's apparently applied less, but DPR was going to check on the usage data for that. So just one note about model assumptions. I think thiamethoxam, I don't know that it's going to turn out to be a big player in toxicity, but it, certainly in terms of what neonicotinoids we're detecting, it's definitely there. And then this is the 2017 data for Ceridaphnia as compared to Chironomus. So the blue bar is showing both survival and reproduction for the water flea. I called it water flea on this slide just so that we don't have to look at two Latin names that both start with the letter C. So water flea versus Chironomus in red. And the Chironomus survival rates, these are both with 96-hour tests, so that's a fairly short test compared to some of the chronic endpoints that Bryn Phillips was talking about yesterday. And so this high Chironomus survival, in some cases, I'll show you in a subsequent graph where we found the neonicotinoids. In some cases, I think we're just not finding the neonicotinoids in those hydrologic units. In other cases, I think that we are finding them, but we're finding them below the level that would be toxic in a 96-hour test. And then we have our lower Chironomus survival in the Santa Maria and Salinas areas. Interestingly, this water flea reproduction endpoint in some cases is more sensitive than the Chironomus endpoint. I don't know which chemical they're responding to.
Were all those indigenous?
In terms of where the test organisms were obtained from, or do they live in these areas?
Yeah.
So no, these are laboratory-reared test organisms, and that's the same with the Hialalla. In terms of what actually lives in the water bodies, when we do perform bioassessment, we do find Hialalla here in Central Coast streams. I've never been able to confirm that Ceridaphnia is actually native to this area. We've certainly never found it, and our ecology lab couldn't give me any examples of that. So I think with the Ceridaphnia and possibly with the Chironomus as well, they're being used as a sensitive indicator as opposed to something that's necessarily out there actually living in our Central Coast watersheds.
Okay, thanks for the clarification.
Okay, and nearing the end of my slides here, just a little bit more detail on what we found with respect to neonicotinoids. The orange bars are thiamethoxam. The green bars are imidacloprid. And the blue bars are acetamiprid, and pink bars are clothianidin. Clothianidin is a breakdown product that, when I've looked at least the 96-hour LC50s are similar to those for imidacloprid. So I don't know about LC50s for longer tests. But we found nothing in the San Ynez hydrologic unit, just some imidacloprid here in the South Coast area, and some imidacloprid in the San Luis Obispo area. More detections in the Pajaro, Salinas, and Santa Maria units, with the highest detection frequencies in Santa Maria. And then this is just some detail. This is only for the Salinas hydrologic unit, but it's some detail as to what those concentrations look like. And these are in nanograms per liter or parts per trillion. And a few things that I would point out, these high values are of thiamethoxam, and the LC50s for thiamethoxam are up here on the ceiling. They're way off this graph. Same for imidacloprid, however, which is the green bars. However, this is the US EPA benchmark for imidacloprid. This is the European chronic exposure limit, and you can see we do have a few imidacloprid detections that exceeded that limit. And as far as the sort of 10-day test LC50s that Bryn talked about yesterday, those are down in this area. And so you can see these green bars, this imidacloprid, very few of them extend even into the LC50 range for a 96-hour test. So it's not until you get down into these chronic exposure limits that things are being exceeded. We do have some high thiamethoxam spikes in some of our ag-dominated tributaries. We also possibly see some urban influence where we look at the wreck ditch. It's not the red ditch, it's the wreck ditch. This is the below Salinas site, and here's the above Salinas site. So we got higher detections below Salinas than we did above Salinas. And that concludes my presentation. Did you want to do questions now or wait until the rest of the speakers go?
No, I think it would be good to do it now. Well, it's, you know, because there's a lot of information, so it keeps it fresh in everybody's mind. Go ahead.
Thank you, Sarah, for all your work. Can you go to back a few slides to the annual average pesticide concentration in water for OPs and neonic? So the imidacloprid, that's the, I'm colorblind, but it's the circle on the right. So it looks like orange to me, I don't know.
Yeah.
So is that at about the 200 nanograms per liter concentration?
That, right, and that's the average of all sites, so all the concentrations that we measure. And because it's an average and not a median, it is skewed by a few very high values that we measure. So if I were to show you what was the typical imidacloprid concentration that we measured it would actually be much lower. But on an average basis, when you include the influence of those very high detections, it ends up around, it's probably around 230 nanograms.
And what would it be if you only included the typical ones, not the outliers? Is it under 100, under 55?
I don't know that it would be under 50. If you included all the non-detects, it would be significantly lower than that.
Well, the reason I'm asking is because I'm referring back to the imidacloprid toxicity that Brian showed us yesterday.
Yes.
And it has a benchmark from EPA chronic at 10. So to me, the 230 is pretty high compared to the 10. And then the same table he gave us gave chronic neonicotinoid protection at 35. Well, this is higher than that if it's
right.
230. And then the acute neonic protection was at 200, which is approximating the 230 that you just mentioned. So I'm just trying to compare what we heard yesterday to what you're saying today and try to put it in context.
Right. So I think my impression, I think I'm with you, but my impression of the data is that when we're looking at the lower chronic thresholds that are on the order of 10 to 50, I think we see some exceedances of those. When we look at the 96-hour LC50, which is an acute, very acute lethal objective, we never exceed that. But then when you look at some of Bryn's intermediate LC, like for I think he's got a 10, is it a 10 or 28-day test on there?
28.
Okay. That's the case where we might see occasional exceedances of that with those very high values. And the reason that's of interest to me is because I also like to think about where are the cases in our data set where we're going to do that chironomous bioassay and also measure the neonicotinoids and see, we had some chironomous mortality in our test and we had a corresponding high neonicotinoid detection. I don't think we're going to see that with the 96-hour test. We might see it a little bit with the longer test, but even with the longer test, I guess what I was trying to say is even with those longer tests, except for the fact that this is skewed high, a lot of our detections are even below those longer test LC50s.
Thank you, sir.
On my left, any other question?
No.
On my right?
Okay.
Thank you very much. Very informative. Appreciate all your good work. So we can proceed with the next presentation.
All the staff are going to gather at the table since we're going to have a series of presentations for you.
All right, drum roll. Okay, Mary Hamilton with our staff will now present central coast ambient monitoring data. Sorry? No, thank you.
Thank you, Chris. Let me take 1 second to figure out this little pointer here. Got it. All right, Chairman Wolf and members of the board, I'm Mary Hamilton, environmental scientist, staff at the Water Board. I'm going to talk to you today about overall water quality conditions in the Central Coast region. And before I begin, I'd like to thank the speakers who went before me for showing you details about their individual monitoring programs. And I'm going to incorporate the data from those programs with the CCAMP data to kind of give you an overall picture, including data from multiple programs for multiple parameters. First, I'd like to say that our speakers that spoke before me have access to their most recent data. And Sarah Lopez, for example, she spent the last couple of weeks redoing all of her analysis and pulling together the 2017 data from her program, which I do not have to share with you today. This presentation is based on publicly available data that is in the CEDIN database. And as soon as that data is updated, we, of course, will update our analysis as well. But it's very important to give you the most important, the most recent data for you to consider. And Sarah and our other speakers incorporated last year's data as well. So the analysis I show you today is missing the last year of data, but we have a long enough data stream at most of our sites that I think the big picture is obvious here.
So you have up through 2016?
In most cases, yeah. Yes. So today I'll be giving you an overall status and trend update for these parameters and putting those in the perspective of meeting water quality objectives and protecting beneficial uses. Real quick, I wanted to show you kind of a region-wide spatial distribution of the cooperative monitoring program sites that Sarah just discussed. Because they are focused in agricultural areas that are on the 303D list of polluted waters for agricultural pollutants. So when you look at this map, you can see that those sites are in the lower areas of the Pajar River, Galvan, Tembladero, and Lower Salinas watershed, in Morro Bay, San Luis Obispo, Arroyo Grande. This is the Santa Maria and Oso Flaco watershed, San Ynez River, and a few sites in Goleta and Carpinteria. So these sites are targeting agricultural areas. And on this map, you'll see the agricultural areas shown in green and the developed urban areas in pink. Clearly, you can't see that well on this slide, but we'll get into the detail there. And I point that out because I wanted to also show you the network of CCAMP monitoring sites throughout our region, which are throughout multiple landscapes. The CCAMP program has over 190 sites region-wide. The CCAMP program targets all major large water bodies and their tributaries. We place sites to bracket land use changes. So for example, here in Santa Barbara, we have two sites on Mission Creek, one very close to the harbor at the bottom of the creek, and another site above the city on Mission Creek. So we're bracketing a major land use change. But in between those two sites, multiple non-point source areas. Both programs conduct monthly monitoring for things like nutrients and physical parameters like flow and dissolved oxygen and turbidity. And then both programs also do seasonal monitoring for things like toxicity and pesticides. So I just wanted to give you kind of a picture of the two big regionally scaled monitoring programs and also let you know that we're going to include data today from the Stream Pollution and Trends program, which is the statewide study Brian Phillips discussed yesterday, as well as several of our very robust volunteer monitoring programs who provide their data to the CEDIN statewide database. One quick thing I wanted to take a moment to point out about all of these monitoring programs is they all have a targeted study design, meaning sites are placed with purpose. It's not a randomized study design. They're targeting certain areas. And so these programs are very well designed to tell so that we can evaluate status, identify trends, identify areas where follow-up may be needed. But they are limited in their ability to for us to detect causality or identify specific sources. Like I mentioned for the Mission Creek example, sites are often multiple miles apart with many potential sources in between. So identifying a source area and or measuring the effect of a certain management practice at an area in between that large spatial extent is challenging. So I'm going to dive into the water quality conditions for the entire region and talk about status in terms of meeting water quality objectives and protecting beneficial uses, and look at trends and change over time. I just noticed this is an older version of my presentation. No, I don't think it's significant. I'll work with it. Okay, first we're starting with a map here of the Central Coast region sites from multiple programs. And this map is the first in the series I'm going to show you where the sites are scored using the CCAMP site scoring approach. Now, this takes into consideration relevant thresholds and water quality objectives and scores the sites based on the frequency of an exceedance and the magnitude of each exceedance. So the color scheme you see here, Mayor Delgado, I apologize, I'm learning today that you probably can't see these colors, but the darker sites hopefully show up to you, oops, as red, and there are two shades of red here, both indicating a site exceeding criteria frequently and by a large amount. Sites that are colored yellow on this map exceed a criteria occasionally, but far less magnitude than sites that are colored red. And when you see a site that's colored green, that means it's meeting the water quality objective or threshold. Quickly want to plant this seed in your mind. I'm going to talk about individual parameters over the next several slides, but multiple parameters add up to tell us something about the overall health of a stream or the support of beneficial uses. So in the case of aquatic life, for example, this is an overall index score for these sites that incorporates data from nutrients, dissolved oxygen, turbidity, and water temperature. There are other factors that also affect aquatic life uses, like toxicity and pesticides and metals and things like that. But the overall health of a stream is based on multiple parameters. So as I go through the individual ones, keep this concept in mind, please. Starting with nitrate, as many of us do, this is a map of our region scoring the sites for nitrate when compared to the aquatic life threshold, which is 1 milligram per liter. As Sarah mentioned, this is a value that is based on trout's ability to find food and avoid predation. It also, that's for turbidity. Wow. This is a value that's from our evaluation of all of our data for CCAMP that we evaluated nitrate and oxygen and chlorophyll and algae from all of the sites for which we had data and found that sites where we don't seem to have eutrophication, evidence of eutrophication, no algae or low amounts of algae and chlorophyll and oxygen stays within a healthy range. All those sites had nitrate levels below 1, whereas sites that had nitrate higher than 1, we found variation in oxygen below healthy levels, often accompanied by algal blooms or chlorophyll in the water column. So these sites are scored compared to the aquatic life threshold. And you can see that there are many sites throughout the region that are scoring red, meaning they exceed this criteria often and by a large amount. And I'm going to show you that the agricultural areas that Sarah already discussed have a high number of those sites. In fact, the Lower Pajaro, Lower Salinas, and Lower San Marias, 80% of the sites that are scoring red on this map are found in those three areas. But we are seeing nitrate. Was there a question?
No, but also right here.
So the next point I was going to make is there are many other places that are exceeding 1 milligram per liter. And those include areas in the upper part of the Salinas River and below municipal waste discharges and urban areas in Morro Bay, in San Luis Obispo, mixed ag and urban in Arroyo Grande, San Ynez River below the city of Lompoc, and several sites that you can see here along the Santa Barbara coastline. This is the Goleta area. We are right here. And this is the Carpinteria area, which is the area for the Team Daly guys considered this morning.
Mary, because I'm color challenged, can you tell me if there's any excellent or good dots in the Lower Pajaro, Lower Salinas?
Lower Pajaro, yes, there are a few. Lower Salinas, including the Gabon Timbalero watershed, no, there are not.
So
there are many, though, along... Oh, sorry, please continue.
So excellent or good, there are some in Lower Pajaro and none in the Salinas area?
Correct.
Okay.
And the ones in Lower Pajaro, I should clarify that they are in the upper parts of tributaries or the upper parts of the river.
Okay. And then excellent to good in Lower Santa Maria?
No.
All right. Thank you.
You're welcome. But I do want to thank you for bringing up excellent or good. There are many sites in the region that are meeting the nitrate threshold. And we see those in areas of Santa Cruz north of Watsonville, the Carmel River, the entire coastline between Carmel and Morro Bay, with one exception, which I'll talk about in the next slide. And sites in the upper part of the Cuidama, Sisquoc, San Ynez watershed, and a few sites along the Santa Barbara coastline. So there are plenty of sites in the region that are achieving this threshold. Same map, same sites, this time scored using 10 milligrams per liter, which is the maximum contaminant level for drinking water. This is protective of human health uses, but not of aquatic life uses. sites that are colored red on this map are more concentrated in the lower ends of Pajaro, Salinas, including Gabon, Tembladero, and Santa Maria, but also below municipal waste discharge points on San Simeon Creek. And if you recall, we brought to the board data from San Simeon Creek where a treatment upgrade to nitrate in November of 2015 resulted in immediate improvement in nitrate in the creek adjacent. So assuming that continues, we'll be recommending to remove San Simeon Creek from the 303D list in the near future. Other sites below municipal waste discharge points are on Trillo Creek, San Luis Obispo Creek, and the San Ynez River. But in general, sites that are exceeding 10 milligrams per liter are in the intensive agricultural areas or below waste discharge points.
Mary, a question. I'm sorry, going back to the prior map, you mentioned that there was one area in San Luis Obispo relative to Mr. Delgado's question. There was one site in the San Luis Obispo area that you were going to comment on.
Yes, that was San Simeon Creek. I pointed it out in the context of the 10 milligram per liter criteria just because the dot shows up a little better on that map. Pardon, don't breathe.
Thank you.
No laughing at the mic.
Yeah.
You're welcome. Okay, so again, I just reiterate that the majority of the sites exceeding 10 milligrams per liter are found in the ag areas or below waste discharge points. Now I want to talk about trends.
So quickly, you know, circling back to, you know, creeks where we do have wastewater discharge from water treatment plant. You know, the big difference where you have plants with tertiary treatment, denitrification. I mean, how do we plug that in? Because particularly in the outfall areas, particularly, you know, when there's discharge in the creek, there is a direct influence. And, you know, that's one of the efforts done by the Regional Water Board is enhanced treatments. Where does that fit with your little dots?
Well, and these dots are simply scoring the condition as we measure at the sites that exist,
right,
where we've targeted them. So if we have a dot in the right place, right below a discharge point, we can tell you something about the quality if that's the dominant source,
mm-hmm,
at that location. Otherwise, there are multiple potential sources in between.
The reason I asked that, sorry to interrupt you, mm-hmm, is because, you know, sometimes we look at this and correlate it directly to agricultural discharge, but,
mm-hmm,
we do have contribution also from,
absolutely,
water treatment facilities, and that's something that we need to address also in our wish list.
And for your, just for your awareness, three of the wastewater treatment discharges, sorry, the wastewater treatment plants have improved treatment to their nitrate, like San Simeon, also the Lompoc treatment plant, and the Men's Colony treatment plant, which discharges to Choro Creek. So we have seen dramatic improvement downstream in nitrate there, but the concentrations are still exceeding aquatic life thresholds, for example.
Right, because Title 22 water does contain nitrates. Okay,
correct.
Thanks for the clarification.
You bet.
Kind of a different question than this, but it's I'm trying to reconcile what Sarah showed us,
mm-hmm,
and with what you're showing us.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think I could quickly get my answer, my question answered, if I ask you if C-Camp has any stations near her 309 SSP, 309 SAC, 309 SAG, because those are all green?
Yes, and we do.
And so does your
CMP? This includes the CMP data also, so our data is here. So I guess when I said I would include, you're right, apologies, I would include the SAC site in the lower Salinas area. And in fact, that site on the main stem is meeting the 1 milligram per liter threshold. And so I misspoke when I said absolutely none in the lower Salinas. That site, SSP, is green. It may be the only one I can think of, though. Because farther downstream, we have, once farther downstream is Blanco Drain, and once that comes into the Salinas River is exceeding 10 milligrams per liter sometimes.
But CCAMP has sites separate from these, the HER 309 series.
We have some that are shared sites. We monitor some of the same places, and we also have additional sites in the area.
And how does your shared sites compare? How does your data from the shared sites compare with their data?
There's no difference between the data, but they're telling the same story.
Okay. And how about with sites that you have nearby, their sites? How does the data compare?
You know, it depends. It just depends on what's going on between sites, right? So there can be significant changes in between. For example, on Santa Maria Watershed, we have, the CCAMP program has additional sites upstream of where the CMP sites are, because they're concentrated in the agricultural areas. So we have sites within the city limits, for example. We also have sites up on the Sisquoc River. Oops, I was going to push the slide button. Up here above the city and the agricultural area. So these sites are showing something very different, but they have different influences as well. But the sites that we have nearby down in the city and agricultural areas of Santa Maria, they're, for the most part, all telling the same story, that there's a lot of nitrate in those waters.
Thank you.
You're welcome. So next I'm going to talk about trend, and to demonstrate the trend analysis we did, I'm using data from the San Ynez River, and this site is located directly downstream of the wastewater treatment plant discharge point. This is nitrate data since 2001, and we identified a significant change in the data, which is the point at which the data before that red arrow have a high probability of being significantly different than the data after that arrow. So once we identify a change point, we then run a statistical analysis to compare those two groups of data. And in fact, the data before have a much higher, significantly different nitrate concentration than the data after. And the next question is this site meeting water quality objectives? So I've added the two human health and aquatic life thresholds to this graph so that you can see that recent data since the change point, for the most part, are meeting the human health threshold, but are not meeting the aquatic life threshold.
Mary, is this a reflection kind of to Dr. Wolf's comment about wastewater treatment influence, plant-influenced
absolutely.
Streams?
And so in this case, we know exactly cause and effect. We know what happened here. Our site is directly downstream of the discharge point from the city. In dry season, that water discharges into dry riverbeds, so it is the primary source of water there. Directly following the upgrade going online at that treatment plant, we saw an immediate reduction in nitrate in the river downstream. So
what's the discharge limit for nitrate on that treatment plant?
I would speculate it's 10, but I'd have to ask staff if they would look it up.
Do we know?
I'm not sure anybody in the room knows the permit.
No, I don't know. Offhand. We can find that out, though.
So this is the trend analysis that we have done, and to show you trends for nitrate region-wide, we looked at all the data we had, enough samples to conduct a trend analysis, and found that for the majority of sites, there is no significant change or trend in nitrate. But at 20 sites, we see significant increase in concentration, and those sites are across multiple landscapes, including forested areas, urban, and agriculture. We see decreasing concentration at 24 sites in the region, and just focusing on those, we evaluated how many of those sites improved to the point where they're actually meeting water quality objectives. None of the sites that were degraded improved to the point where they're now meeting aquatic life threshold, but four sites that were degraded did improve to meet the 10 milligram per liter threshold. So just to kind of loop back to what I just told you, there is no trend at the majority of sites for nitrate region-wide when incorporating data from all across the region. We do have significant trends of improvement at 13% of the sites for which we have data region-wide. Those are located in multiple landscapes. And four of those sites that were degraded to begin with improved to the point where they're now meeting water quality objectives. However, the cause of improvement is uncertain for the majority of the sites. For the four sites that showed improvement that are downstream of wastewater treatment upgrades, we have pretty strong confidence in the fact that we think the wastewater treatment plant is responsible, but otherwise sites are not well placed to be diagnostic and tell us specific improvements related to the change we see in the creek.
So we can't say what the content of those the 13%, we can't really...
Not for four of them, yes, but the others we cannot.
So those that have uncertainty at most sites, does staff have any idea how many of those sites have known substantive BMPs that may be influencing it? Or is that a blank slate?
Absolutely. We have some information that, as part of the order, GRS report management practices for their farms. But there are so many miles, for example, between sites that the concentration at one site that is 7 or 8 miles away from the next may have some implementation on some of the farms in between, for example, but we can't draw strong conclusions there.
So I think it would be just a point of helpfulness if I, as a board member, were told that concentration improvement at 13% of the sites, all or most of those sites have had substantive BMPs, but we don't know if they're connected to the improvement. That would just be, and it happens that none of them do, or half of them do, and half of them don't. That would just help me further along the connection to see how we're making progress with the ag order. Thanks.
Noted. I see people writing furiously. Okay. Moving on from nitrate, sediment toxicity data. Pardon.
Just a quick question. So concentration is improving, but clearly when we're looking talk to me about the drought, and it would be and the whole thing that Sarah Lopez talked about, where in the drought, combination of the drought and increased utilization of drip irrigation. The relationship between concentration and loading. Have you done any calculations on loading? Do we have any sense of, because I think it seems like in the context of that this is an incomplete picture of how we're doing if we're just looking at where concentration is improving, you know?
Agreed. This is, I'm only talking about concentration here, and the loading piece is an important part of the puzzle. We did the loading analysis for all these sites and found similar result. The pie chart looked pretty much the same, except there was less that were getting worse. But the pie chart looked much the same, and the majority of sites in the region did not have a change in load overall. The question about effects of the drought and management practice implementation is an important one. And the slide that Sarah shared with us that showed irrigation practices and the increasing trend of drip and decreasing trend of furrow irrigation, also important data. And I have I am certain that both management practices and the drought has some effect on the data that I'm showing you here, but we do not have the data, nor have we done an analysis that can give us any certainty with respect to saying how much effect that has. We can't quantify it with the information we have. That's a different study design. We need additional data, higher resolution, so that we can get to those questions.
Thank you for not guessing.
You're welcome.
Yeah, that's a good trend of all of you. So thank you very much, Mary. And
wait,
there's more. Because I saw summary.
That was just for nitrate, because I talked about nitrate for so long, I kind of wanted to reel it back in. The next few will be a much shorter discussion. This is a map showing sites that are scored for sediment toxicity. So the test organism Hialala azteca. You'll recall several people mentioned that Hialala is sensitive to pyrethroids. You probably can't see it very well on the screen here, but the majority of the sites where we have toxicity to Hialala in sediment are located in our agricultural and mixed urban areas of Lower Pajaro, Salinas River and its tributaries, including the Galvan-Tembladera watershed and the Santa Maria watershed, as well as a few of the ag and urban areas in Goleta and Carpinteria. Sites outside of this area that also are showing toxicity one site on Lososos Creek in the Morro Bay watershed, as well as this site up here in the very top corner. This is Gazos Creek in the northern part of our region. And this site is in an area that's dominantly forested landscape with some rural residential. Coincidentally, we've got some data that shows DDT in this sediment. And although we can't draw a strong conclusion about that, it was at concentrations high enough that could cause an effect. So again, the majority...
Can you speculate what may be influencing that location?
Gazos Creek? You know, it is forested, and it is in an area where there may have been some illegal growing activity in the area. There are other areas nearby that I'm aware of, but that's speculation, of course. So sediment toxicity primarily in Lower Salinas, Gavilán, Tembladero, and Santa Maria watersheds, but also in some other agricultural and urban areas of the region. This is the same map with sites scored for water toxicity, and these scores are a little different than the sediment toxicity I just showed you, because this score takes into consideration data from multiple test species. So the overall score here shows you if we had toxic effects to invertebrates and or larval fish and or algae. Again, the sites that are scoring dark red, meaning frequent toxicity and a high magnitude of toxic effect, are primarily in the lower ends of our intensive human-influenced watersheds of Santa Maria, Salinas, and Pajaro, but also many sites along the coast of Santa Barbara and in the San Ynez area, Upper Cuyama River, as well as Upper Salinas, are showing algae toxicity. Sarah mentioned algae toxicity, and I wanted to point out that algae are sensitive to a number of things, not only herbicides, but also to metals and also to salinity. And although I can't draw a strong conclusion about the cause, many of these watersheds where we're seeing algae toxicity have naturally high salinities because of the geology and influence from marine deposits in those areas.
So are there any, what do we know about land use in that area? It's interesting to me that this area is coming up across all of these, overview of what's going on where, and trends. What's the land use going on there?
It's varied, and in the areas over here, like Halama Creek, Gaviota Creek, which those of you who came south drove right through that creek corridor as you came down to 101, these sites are El Capitan, Refugio, Dos Pueblos, sites north of Goleta. So these are areas where we have mostly rangeland or open land. There are some roads coming through there. Some of those areas have orchards in the upper watershed areas. And then down farther south in Goleta, Santa Barbara, and Carpinteria, these sites are in mixed urban and or urban and agricultural areas, so variable land uses. And herbicides could be a big picture, big piece of that pie there. But I wanted to point out the salinity is also a factor, and we don't have enough information to draw a strong conclusion about the cause. Also wanted to point out that areas like Carmel River, the San Lorenzo River in Santa Cruz, and Gazos Creek also showed toxicity to the algae species in one sample each. So algae toxicity is a little bit more spread across multiple landscapes, where we're seeing lots of invertebrate toxicity in multiple samples and the high magnitude of toxic effect are in our agricultural areas that some have mixed urban in San Maria, Salinas, and Pajaro. So we evaluated trends region-wide for all of the toxicity data, and because we sample for toxicity less frequently, we don't have a lot of samples, and so we found very few trends, and all the trends that we did find are for Ceridaphnia dubia. We found one trend of significant decreasing survival, meaning more toxic, and that was a site in the Santa Maria Orcutt Creek watershed. And we found three sites with increasing survival, meaning less toxicity. Two of those sites are in the Gavilán Tembladero watershed in the Lower Salinas area, and one site in the Santa Maria area. And although we saw significant less toxicity at three sites, none of those sites improved to meet the aquatic life threshold. And I'm going to use some data to demonstrate what I mean by that. This is a graph of the data from one of the sites where we saw a significant trend. This happens to be the Salinas Reclamation Canal above the city of Salinas. This is a site where we see 100% mortality, meaning all of the test organisms died in the sample for each of these blue dots as a sample. And then after the change point, the significant change point in the data, we see more variability, where samples that are below this red line are typically not toxic, samples above the line typically toxic. Now, this red line is not a hard line. Based on the control performance, that red line can be plus or minus, but just in general, not toxic, toxic. So although we see significantly less toxicity, toxicity less frequency, there's still some toxicity there, and the aquatic life threshold is not being met.
Mary, I'm sorry, did you say what the change point was due to?
No, I didn't say what it's due to.
Do we know?
Well, no, not with any certainty, of course, because if we wanted to try to link that directly to a pesticide concentration, for example, we would need pesticide data with each of these toxicity samples, and that's not something that we have access to. So we can't say with any certainty. For the same site, I wanted to show you toxicity data from Hyalella in sediment, another test organism, and we did not see a change here. Again, the samples on this 100 line are 100% mortality, meaning all the test organisms died. So there's no significant change in the Hyalella test organism. So just to kind of bring this into the overall concept of supporting beneficial uses and meeting all water quality objectives, this is just a map showing you where the site is. If you can see this line, this is Alisal Creek. Where it comes into the city of Salinas, the red dot is where the site is that I'm talking about. Flows through the city, meets with the flows from Gablon and Natividad Creek, and flows out through Tumbladeros to the ocean. So at this site, we did see some improving trends in both toxicity to Cerodaphnia and in nitrate load, but we are seeing declining condition in other parameters, and many water quality objectives are being exceeded at this site. So that overall, this site is not supporting beneficial uses. I want to circle back to this pesticide data, which you've already seen. This is Department of Pesticide Regulation application data or use data. And reiterate the point of declining chlorpyrifos and diazinon use between 2010 and 2015, more than 90% reduction region-wide, while at the same time an increase of use of neonicotinoid and pyrethroid pesticides. And the neonicotinoid and pyrethroid pesticides, as many speakers before me have already mentioned, are being detected in our creeks at concentrations that are known to cause toxic effects. I'm not trying to imply that the use data can be used to draw direct links to concentrations we find in the creeks or the toxic effects I just showed you, but these data, the pesticide use data, are very useful, and using Dr. Luo's model that you heard about yesterday, they can inform where and what we should be monitoring for based on risk assessment. I'm not going to talk a lot about pesticides, but I'm going to show you yet more maps. This is the region with sites scored according to a pesticide index. So this index incorporates all the pesticide data we have for a site, compares that data to a relevant criteria or threshold, and the site is scored accordingly. So sites scored red here exceed one or more pesticide thresholds by a lot. outside of the agricultural areas where we have already heard about some of the pesticide concentrations, I wanted to point out some sites in the Santa Cruz area. This is San Lorenzo River. And San Lorenzo River, at two sites as well as two of its tributaries, we found chlorpyrifos at elevated concentrations. That site is already on the 303D list for that insecticide. Also, at Gazos Creek, where I mentioned we had some sediment toxicity, and at Scott Creek, we have found legacy pesticides, DDT. The same is true for Carmel River at the lower end of the river, where we found not only DDT, but also some pyrethroid pesticides. And then I also wanted to point out the areas of San Luis Obispo, Arroyo Grande, Pismo Creek in San Luis Obispo County, where we're seeing elevated levels of pyrethroid pesticides.
Question, Mary?
Yes.
Is this about insecticides solely or a broader range of pesticides, this slide?
So our index does have the capacity to evaluate pesticides in general, all of them, but the data that I'm showing you here are all insecticides.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Okay, moving on, I want to talk about one more individual parameter before talking about overall condition. This map is scoring sites based on turbidity, and now I can tell you again about that threshold at 25 NTUs, which is for trout specifically and their ability to find food and avoid predation. Areas where we have areas where, that are scoring well for this parameter are found all throughout Santa Cruz north of Watsonville, the Carmel River, and the coastline all the way south through San Luis Obispo County. Many of the sites in the upper Salinas watershed, as well as sites, most of the sites in San Ynez River and Sisquoc River, and many sites along the coast. So there are sites region-wide across multiple landscapes that are meeting this threshold. Now, turbidity should be very short-lived when you have a rain event, and turbidity should dissipate quickly following the end of a runoff event. But where we have sustained turbidity, we have multiple exceedances of this criteria, and those areas are found in Yagas and Pajaro River, Lower Salinas, and the Gablon-Tembadero watershed, and Santa Maria, as well as a few places in Goleta.
Do we have any idea if that increased turbidity is due to like algal growth and related to nutrients, or we don't?
Great question. So yes, turbidity can be from algae or other suspended materials, but the primary turbidity that we see in our region is primarily sediment particles. We evaluated turbidity region-wide for trends and found the majority of sites did not have a significant change, but that turbidity is increasing at three of our sites. All three are not degraded, though. All three of those sites were in good condition before the change was detected and remain in good condition, meaning they're scoring green still, even though they have increasing turbidity. 27 sites where we detected decreasing turbidity region-wide or improving turbidity condition. Those sites are also across multiple landscapes, but the majority of them are in agricultural areas, but also sites that are in rural, residential, and urban and forested landscapes. We had only 15 sites that were in degraded condition with a decreasing trend. So 12 of those sites were scoring green before and continue to score green, for example, but also show improvement in turbidity. To show you data from one example of a site that had a significant declining trend of turbidity, this is data from the Pajaro River below Watsonville, where condition improved from degraded to meeting the aquatic life threshold. So you can see that before the change point, the significant change point in time, there was variability and many exceedances of the aquatic life threshold. And after the change, the majority, almost all sites, all samples are meeting the 25 NTU threshold.
Do we have any idea if that's drought related? If it's mostly sediment, I would assume.
Yeah, this is a big river at the bottom of a watershed, and I'm fairly certain that drought has some effect on it, but I can't quantify that with this data.
But I think drought can have effects also by having stress to riparian vegetation, which then reduce your buffer strip and infiltration, so that when you do have rain events, you don't have a whole lot of vegetative material to capture the sediment, so you have that compounding effect, right?
Yes, important point. So this is the data from the one site that improved in condition all the way to now meeting the threshold, from red to green on the map, if you will. I want to show you where the site's located. This is the Pajaro River below the city of Watsonville. This is the river coming through here. So it's the very bottom of the watershed. Important for aquatic life are improvements, significant improvements in turbidity and nitrate. Nitrate now meets the aquatic life threshold, or sorry, the human health threshold at this site, but not the aquatic life threshold. And overall, there are also problems with oxygen and water temperature at this site. And seasonal algal blooms at this location, year after year, are visible evidence of a continued degraded condition. So now I'm going to transition to overall health region-wide, combining multiple water quality factors or parameters and relevant thresholds. So thinking about human health first, this index combines data for multiple nutrients and thresholds that are protective of drinking water and groundwater recharge. This map is heavily influenced by the nitrate data, obviously, and if you do remember what the nitrate map for human health looked like, it's very similar where sites exceeding that maximum contaminant level are in the lower ends of our major agricultural areas and below treated waste discharge points. I'm going to zoom in on these so you can see them a little bit better. This is a map of the northern half of our region, and outside of those areas of intensive agricultural and urban use, we can see that the areas north of Watsonville, all sites in Aptos, Soquel, San Lorenzo River, and north are meeting human health thresholds for nutrients, as are sites in the Salinas River upstream of the Chular area and into Arroyo Seco River and Carmel River down the coast. Looking at the southern half of our region and comparing to multiple nutrient thresholds, San Luis Obispo Creek anchors this map in the top left corner. Both sites below the city of San Luis Obispo's waste discharge point are exceeding human health thresholds, as are sites on a tributary to Arroyo Grande Creek, sites in the Osa Flaco watershed, lower Santa Maria below the city and above, sites on San Ynez below the wastewater treatment plant and tributaries in the agricultural areas downstream, and sites on Bell Creek, Glen Annie Creek, Franklin and Arroyo Peridon, and Carpinteria. All of these sites are exceeding human health thresholds. Same concept here, but this time looking at aquatic life thresholds and data, so multiple nutrients, phosphorus, nitrate, ammonia, dissolved oxygen, turbidity, and water temperature, and scoring the site based on its condition related to the relevant thresholds here. Zooming in, we see that this is a pretty high bar, so I want to focus here on sites that are actually meeting all of these thresholds and show you that sites in the northern part of the region, in Santa Cruz, with the exception of the San Lorenzo River Lagoon, sites on the Salinas watershed in Arroyo Seco, and sites along the coast, including the entire Carmel River watershed and south, are meeting all of these thresholds. Similarly, in the south, we have sites in the upper part of many watersheds that are meeting these thresholds on the Cuyama River, in the Sisquoc River watershed, in the Cuyama River watershed, and along the coast, Gaviota, a few in Montecito, although I fear they're not faring very well today, and the upper parts of Mission Creek and Carpinteria Creek. And so with that, we do have many sites region-wide that are meeting water quality objectives. But I'll conclude by saying we have many sites that do not meet water quality objectives and therefore are not supporting beneficial uses. We evaluated pollutants, trends for pollutants region-wide, and found that in most cases there are no trends for most sites. But there are some important trends of improvement for individual parameters. However, sites that are degraded remain degraded overall, and the causality of changes in individual pollutants is uncertain for most cases. Staff are well aware that that is a need, and we are working on different options to develop monitoring programs that can better get at those questions. But that's something we're working on at this point. And with that, I will conclude by just acknowledging that I recognize I'm standing on the shoulders of giants, and I want to thank Karen Wooster and Dave Paradis for their development of the CCAM scoring approach and the Data Navigator tool, where you can go and look at all of the data I just showed you. So if you had questions about TMDL effectiveness for a certain creek and you want to know what the status of a creek is, you can go and see how it's scoring compared to relevant criteria on our website. So everything I just showed you is already publicly available. And I also wanted to thank Melissa Doherty, who's contributed significantly to my presentation. She staffed the water warden. She made all the maps that I know you enjoyed so much. Thank you.
Thank you. And let's see.
Quick question here.
Just a very quick question.
Yeah.
Actually, more of an observation. I'm curious, the Carmel seems to be doing okay, and I know that there are farming operations even up in the higher areas of the watershed. Is it just low intensity that allows that the Carmel to sustain at higher quality levels, or what do you think?
I'll tell you my opinion. There's a lot of factors that contribute to the water quality there, and there is a lot of agricultural and culture practices going on in the valley there. But the river is bracketed by a very large and wide riparian corridor, so there are some filtering capacity there. There are not, to my knowledge, any direct discharges from sources that are likely to have a high nutrient concentration, for example. And so I think factors like that are contributing to its ability to assimilate the pollutant load it does receive, and so we're not picking up a large concentration, for example.
Mm-hmm.
But that's my opinion.
So we don't really know if there is a good runoff control necessarily. It's more, it would be more valid to say the riparian buffer, kind of ecological filtering that's going on there is a higher
probability. That's an important question. And
yeah.
I think we do have some data from the reporting of the growers on practices at the farm level. So it would be important to evaluate those and see if something different is going on in a location like that than elsewhere. And I have not done that analysis. But admitting that I don't know the answer to that question, that could be a factor, but we just haven't done the analysis. Thank you for bringing that up. That's an important point.
Mayor Delgado?
Yeah, first follow-up to something that Monica just asked regarding Carmel River. I know in San Lorenzo there's a problem with leaky septics. In the Carmel River watershed, is there a high percentage of residential that use septic? Or do we know?
That's a good question. I'm not sure. We can find out.
Maybe they can afford to maintain their septics.
Can you? Not really. Not. I mean, there's a lot of low-income residential use in the Carmel Valley. So, and I believe there's a high number of septics. But
I believe there's two.
Yeah, it's great if there's a high number of septics, and yet the stream is not suffering much from that. Can you go back a few slides to human health index scores? Right there. So Jane pointed out to me that there's a very poor next to a good circle on the Santa Maria River. Can you use your pointer? It's about halfway up the large central ag area. Just a little bit up to the left.
Up and to the left.
Right, just down to the right.
Yeah.
Right, those two. So
these two.
Can you describe those two dots, what they're...
Absolutely. This is... This dot here and this dot here are both on Bradley Channel. That is a system that flows from the agricultural areas and also receives input from the freeway that runs through here and from the large box stores on this side of the freeway. That flows to retaining ponds here next to the river that then flows across in a channel to this location, which is Blosser Channel, and Blosser Channel flows to the river downstream of that point. The green circle that you see here is actually on the river. That site is typically dry, so we only have a few data points at that site, and those are all during rain events when we have a flushing event, if you will.
Okay, so part of the explanation of poor, very poor next to good is that the poor are on a channel that has obvious issues, and the good is in a river that has more flow and less input of pollutants. Okay, thank you.
You're welcome. Good eye.
Mr. Young?
Thank you. So on your conclusions page...
I apologize, this is not the polished version of the conclusions. Like I mentioned, this is not my final.
All right, so when you say no trends at most sites, are you using the word trends to mean whether the levels are increasing or decreasing?
Correct.
And you're not referring to a constant.
No.
What I would call trend in the same direction.
Right. I would call that a pattern, as Sarah describes. I like that she took the time to define the difference between what she meant and a pattern, when you can see what you think looks like a trend. But for that to be meaningful, we use the statistical test to tell us how powerful that trend is or how confident we can be in the trend. So when I say trend, I mean statistically significant trend.
Yeah, but you could have no change upward or downward through time,
mm-hmm.
and that would still be a trend that supports, you know, like an average.
I would call it a pattern, but yes, it can still be a pattern. Agreed. Just to be clear about what we mean when we say trend, I would use the term pattern there. But yes, it is something.
The status quo is a trend.
Yeah. And so all of the sites that I showed, for example, on this slide, too many. The 157 sites where we did not see a significant change there, all of those sites have no statistically significant change. That could be variable data where there's just too much variation, so there's no difference between the earlier data and the later data. That could be a pattern that shows some trend, but it's not a strong enough pattern for it to be significant, and it could be a flat line. Those no change, that 157 no change, could be any variety of patterns, but what it's not is statistically significant difference between the data in this group and that group.
So status quo is a pattern unless it's statistically significant, and then it would be a trend.
Correct.
Okay.
Well, it's a good point. It's a fair point. I hear you.
It's just a use of words.
Yeah.
To me, you know, so it gets kind of confusing. Patterns and trends. So
I think I hear you saying that you'd like to know how many are status quo with very little variability.
Well, for instance, see, I no change in 157 sites. I could say, well, the trend is that the trend at those sites is to not meet aquatic life threshold.
That is not the case, no. So some of those sites are scoring green, for example, some are scoring red. There's in all the data we evaluated, that's all sites and all data. So the condition of those sites becomes more evident later. So what I could do, if the board places, is create the same graph for only degraded sites, for example. That's a different question.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
You're welcome.
All right. So I think this wraps up the questions and the conclusion from Mary. Do you have one more item associated with Mary's presentation?
Yes, I do. There was a question that came up from Mr. Young regarding the Lompoc wastewater treatment plant effluent limit on nitrate. It's 10 milligrams per liter as nitrogen. Okay, so that's the drinking water standard.
So it's discharging at about the level we're seeing at times in the receiving water.
At this site, yes, I happened to pick the data from right below the treatment discharge point. So you can see that since the upgrade, the majority of the points in the river are below 10 millimeters per liter. There were only two instances where we detected an exceedance of the 10 millimeters per liter in the river.
My question is, why does it have such a high limit versus the aquatic life?
That's a good question.
Standard.
That's a good question, yeah. I don't have an explanation why it's not at the aquatic life number versus the drinking water standard.
Okay.
Well, it could be a number of things, including when the last time that permit was issued. Because the aquatic life has only been something that Karen and her team defined when we started hearing about the aquatic life criteria.
It's a relatively new target.
Recent, yeah.
Yeah, because we had some municipalities asking for the designation of beneficial use, and so it kind of, it's a moving target depending on which facility, which permit, when the enhanced treatment is going to take place, right?
Right, when the upgrade. So I'd like to Harvey real quick. Harvey has a little more information.
Right, and so what I'd like to do, though, for the sake of a meeting organization, is let's wrap up with this particular question. So Harvey, did you need to, if you had to supplement information, go ahead.
Harvey Packer, Water Board staff. So I'll just mention that permits from 2011, it is due for an update. 10 is the drinking water standards, and it's a number, it's set by US EPA and the state. It's fairly easy to apply to permits for drinking water, for NPS permits. The lower number is a narrative standard in the basin plan. It has not been officially interpreted to a value, a numerical target by the Water Board yet. That would take some justification. And another factor is achievability. Wastewater treatment plants done correctly can achieve 10. One is very much more difficult.
All right. But is that an excuse?
It is a factor with EPA permits, yeah. When you talk about best technology available and things like that.
And technological and economic achievability, too.
All right. So I think this should satisfy my colleagues' questions. Don't always like the answers, but it's a fact. So at this time, what I'd like to do is, we're going to take a break because we have two more 15 minutes presentation from staff. We have some speaker cards, which is probably another half an hour worth. So I think this is a good time to break. We're going to have a closed session at this time. I would like council to make that statement, and we need another and a quarter, correct? Based on the timer you gave me, 75 minutes or 60 minutes? 75 minutes, okay. So before you make your statement, we will reconvene at 1:45.
And just to clarify, we also have a presentation by Abby.
Yeah, that's part of the other 30 minutes.
You said staff.
Yeah.
Thank you.
That your staff, then there will be speaker card, and then it also, I think this item will take another hour to wrap up. So that's why it's best to take a break now. All right. So, council.
All right. So we will be discussing item 6 on the closed session list. In addition, we'll also be discussing whether to initiate litigation under Government Code 11126E2C.
And we will be discussing a personnel item, and we will need the room to be emptied.
Because we're going to meet here due to the size. Okay. So thank you very much. So see you at 1:45. Thank you.